Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Grueling Truth. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Rodriguez. How you doing tonight, Joe?
It's hot here in the Northeast.
Well, you quit whining. It's only hot like 1 month out of the year, so you're always complaining about it freezing all the other time. But we got a special guest tonight. He's getting ready to fight Antonio Tarver, I believe, August the 14th of this year on Spike TV. He's the former cruiserweight champion of the world. Help me welcome to The Grueling Truth, Steve Cunningham. How you doing tonight, Steve?
Hey, what's up? I'm doing good.
All right, well, let's get started off from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your life growing up. I think you grew up in Philadelphia, didn't you?
Yeah, grew up in different parts of Philly. That's part of why I became a fighter, you know, moving around a bit. Was a new kid on the block a few times. So, you know, back then there wasn't a lot of gun violence. So, you know, guys balled their fists and settled things with fights. And I just kind of had to fight for a little respect and a little dignity here and there.
Yeah. Joe?
You know, while this is Joe, Steve, thanks again for joining us. We're really happy to have you with us. Reading up about you, I read that, you know, unfortunately came from a broken home, and you had to survive. You had to resort to dealing drugs as a teenager, and I'm sorry to bring that up, but it's part of your background and what made you today. How did what got you away from doing it? Well, first, what got you into doing that, and how did you get out of it?
Well, initially, I grew up with my mom and dad till I was about 9, and then my parents separated, and we went with my mother, you know, of course, and you know, after that split, it was like it was like crushed, because you know, I looked up to my father, you know, my father was like my Superman, but you know, now here it is, I'm angry, I'm rebellious. You know, I had a bad temper, moving around. I had to basically fight to not get jumped, and I got jumped a few times. And peer pressure set in to make me choose to, you know, go that path of drug dealing. I mean, then at that time, you know, that's when, you know, crack cocaine was just taking over the city, and it seems like a lot of, you know, it was just so easy to get. And about 14 years old, and I remember just getting teased so much, you know. It was fights breaking out because of it, you know, not having the high-priced sneakers and just not having the high-priced clothes. And I really gave into that peer pressure and started, you know, doing this illegal thing. But, you know, I did it for probably about a year and a half at the most. And just, I knew it was time to stop. You know, it was just something in me that's like, man, because, you know, there's guys that I knew who got shot, guys I knew who got killed. I knew a guy who got stuck up for his Jordans, and he got murdered, you know, even though he gave him the brand-new sneakers. You know, just growing up was gonna makes you grow up a little faster, in a sense. So at one point, I remember just really having this thought of, man, I need to graduate high school and do something with my life. You know, if I continue to do this, I'm going to go to jail or even be dead. So it was a short-lived illegal career. I'm totally glad for it, but it did help shape the way I saw the world, though, because here it is, one year, I'm running around playing hide and tag on these streets, and the next summer, you know, I'm dealing crack on these corners, and I'm seeing who's the crack addicts, who's the drug dealers, you know, who's the stick-up kids. And, you know, it's just you saw the dark side of the world, you know, real quick.
Yeah. Well, after graduating high school, I know you joined the Navy. What led to your decision to, after you graduated from high school, join the Navy?
Same, kind of the same thing. You know, it all, even all of this played a part. You know, the drug dealing, you know, I had stopped dealing drugs at, you know, I graduated high school. I wanted to go to art. I wanted to go to the Art Institute of Philadelphia or New York. But at the time, you know, I was living with my mother. My mother was working two jobs, so she couldn't tell me how to prepare, you know, what to do to get to college, you know, financial aid, student loans, or even get my portfolio ready to submit it to these colleges. And art was my major, and I'm sitting there, and all of my friends are getting acceptance letters, you know, to New York, to Philadelphia Art Institute, to different places, Los Angeles, California. I'm like, wow, where's mine? You know, and my art teacher was like, hey, you didn't fill out your paperwork, you know, you didn't do your portfolio. And I knew then, like, wow, I was like, man, my future's screwed. You know, I really wanted to be a graphic designer. I wanted to be an artist. And I'm like, man, you know, what do I do? And it really hit me again, like, I need to do something, because if I stay in Philly, I'm either going to go back to selling drugs, working at Checkers or McDonald's, which I really didn't want to do, which I didn't see any joy in doing that. And either, you know, if I sold drugs, you know, the same conclusion, death or jail. So I just basically was like, man, I need a way out of here. And literally within that week, the Navy recruiter came to my advisory class, started saying the exact things I needed. He's saying college money, GI Bill. He's saying make money. And of course, the last one that really got me was that was it.
So after the Navy, you started, I'm not sure if you started in the Navy or after the Navy, you started your boxing career. How did that get started, and what got you interested?
Well, when I initially went to the recruiter, you know, they have this paperwork and they ask you, what's your hobbies? What do you like doing? So, of course, I put down boxing. I mean, I fought so much in the street that, you know, some people thought that I boxed. But I went to a gym a few times, man, literally a few times out of my life. And I just, you know, I wasn't the best guy fighting, but I didn't win them all, but I didn't lose them all either. So I told the Navy recruiter that he started talking about, you know, the Navy boxing team. And I was like, wow, okay. And so I went through boot camp in Great Lakes, Illinois, graduated boot camp, got stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, Norfolk Naval Base on the USS America. And when my ship was in port, those days I would, you know, after work, I would just go to the gym on Little Creek Amphibious Base, and that's where the Navy boxing team trained. So I would train there every day until Marine guy at the time, he was named Major Hansen. He picked me up and started training me and got me my first fight against the light heavyweight champ of the Navy. And I beat the guy, you know, with one fight, you know.
All right. Tell us a little about your amateur career. I know you won an amateur championship in 1998. Tell us a little bit about your amateur career.
Amateur career, It was a joyous, you know, joyous thing. I messed up about 8 wins before I got my first loss. And ironically, my first loss was a robbery for the guy in Maryland. And I really kicked his butt. He had an eyeball the size of a tennis ball. And they gave him the fight. You know, it was a hometown thing. But
so this has been happening,
you know,
your entire career,
told,
is what you're telling us, Steve.
that was the first loss I ever had. And boxing, and it was a robbery. But the guy who I fought, he's like, man, you really won that fight, man. And, you know, he raised my hand, and, you know, that helped it out a lot more. But I was told that's how the amateurs are, you know. So I went to the Armed Forces tournament in 1998, won the silver medal in that tournament, then went to the U.S. Nationals. I lost to Anthony Stewart, who was number two or number one light heavyweight in the nation. And then the next tournament was the National Golden Gloves. I cleaned the whole thing out. You know, I won the Nationals. So After that, I became a, like a quarter finalist a few times, and I never attempted to go to the Olympics. I lost to Michael Sims, who went to the Olympics, or who made the Olympic team, but he got kicked off the team. But then I decided to go pro in 2000.
So when you turned pro, because it seemed like you had a fairly short amateur career, how'd you feel? Did you feel like you were ready to turn pro, and were you apprehensive? How'd you feel about it?
When I turned pro, I was kind of ready to turn pro, because after I had left the Navy, after I won the National Golden Gloves, in order to pursue this dream of being an Olympic boxer, you know, the Navy, at the time when I was boxing on the Navy team, the lieutenant of my department, he was all for, you know, me boxing. My captain of the ship, he was all for me getting on the Navy boxing team. But then when I got back, we had a change of command, and I had a new lieutenant. I had a new captain boxing in the Navy. They cared about manpower on the ship. So I only had about 6 months left, and I had to make a quick decision. You know, should I get out the Navy and pursue this dream, or should I stay in and try to work it out here? And I just knew it wasn't going to be a smooth enough ride for me in the Navy, so I left. At that time, I moved to Atlanta. Me and my trainer lived in Atlanta, and we were working, and I was working a job and training hardcore in order to make this team. Of course, I didn't make the team, but at that time, I was broke, man. I mean, I was hurting. I needed money. I was kind of sick of working these penny ante jobs. And I mean, but I had this talent, you know. I felt I had this talent, and I'm like, man, there's people making money doing what I do, you know. So, you know, I was just like, hey, I'm going to turn pro. So, I don't know if you guys remember Ebo Elder, but his dad, Greg Elder, had called me on a Saturday morning and was like, hey, Steve, you want? I heard your name's in a hat to be a pro. You want to make your pro debut tonight? And I was like, sure, you know, how much? He said $1,000 for 4 rounds. And I was like, I was broke. I needed money. I was like, heck yeah, you know. So I went to Savannah, Georgia. We drove from Atlanta to Savannah. I beat, I think it was Norman Jones at light heavyweight. Beat him, you know, 4 rounds. And I was a pro. I was officially a pro. 1-0, made $1,000 for 4 rounds. The easiest money I ever made.
Well, you just killed my question about your pro debut. I hope you're happy.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. But then you went to Poland and fought, and I believe that was
yeah.
the first time you got screwed over as a professional. Christoph, whatever
yes.
his name is. But
Ledarchi.
I actually just watched the
Christoph
fight again today.
Ledarchi.
You lost the
yeah.
split decision, and the fight wasn't even close. I mean, what are your memories of that
Thank
night?
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I mean, my memories of that night were depression and anger. You know, I was very
yeah.
mad that night after that fight. First, before that fight, I mean, I had already fought in South Africa. I mean, fighting in someone else's country wasn't taboo to me. But in Poland, when we got to Poland to fight Krzysztof, I mean, I found out that we were the first ever world title fight there. So I go down in the history books for that, you know.
Yeah, they were letting you get out of there
ever. Yeah, no doubt. Exactly. You know, we were the first ever world title fight in Poland. And then, you know, at the rules meeting, you know, I fought and I was sponsored by Grant Glove, you know, Grant Equipment. They wouldn't let me wear my gloves. I had to wear the Everlast gloves that he had. You know, it was just everything was for him, and here it is. I was the number one contender. He was number, I think, three. He only got chosen to fight because O'Neill Bell vacated the title. So here it is, but his promoter won the bid, and, you know, we had to deal with everything that they wanted. I mean, there wasn't even supposed to be a Polish judge on the panel, on the judges' panel, but they somehow judge, a German judge and an Italian judge and an American judge. And I boxed the fight, man. I felt I boxed good, you know. I gave him a few rounds, but I felt I boxed well. And after the fight, right after the bell rung, they gave him the microphone. Before any decision was announced, they gave Krzysztof the microphone, and he started speaking in Polish, given what I totally felt was a victory speech, which I didn't understand, but I just knew. I'm like, is he giving a victory speech? Before the judges even announced, you know, so I kind of knew then that I was robbed. I mean, I literally fell down and broke out into tears in that ring, and I just broke. I was so mad. I told them at the press conference, "You guys made a monster, you know, because if I can box like that and not win, I'm going to go back to the gym and train even harder. You guys created a monster," and sure enough, we got the immediate rematch.
Yeah, and the bad thing about that is the American judge had you winning the fight like 119-109. And then the two Polish judges, which
I think
were his
10 rounds or 11 rounds, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other two were Polish, and I think that was his mom and dad. So, and he still barely beat
him. Right.
But then you had the immediate rematch. Yeah. Go ahead, talk about the rematch.
We got the immediate rematch. Those guys, they did so many things wrong. I mean, illegal. I mean, so many things against the rules that I think they confused themselves. You know, they were just doing it the way they wanted to, and they were just so excited to finally have this world title here, and they knew they were going to rob it somehow. So they crossed a lot of T's and dotted a lot of I's, and we got them on not giving the drug test. I don't know if he was on steroids or anything or whatever, but they didn't give us the drug test, your analysis. So IBF rules is you must have a after fight urinalysis after championship fight, and I didn't give them. We filed the protest, we won the protest, got the immediate rematch, and I had to go back to Poland.
Well, and you won a close decision in a fight that shouldn't have been close also, by the way, so they almost got you again.
Yeah,
I think it was a majority decision, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was another ridiculous thing, but this time I knew from that first fight, what that first fight showed me is, and I learned from everything, I tried to, and from what that first fight showed me was, I went over there and I boxed him like I normally fight, you know, I fought him like I normally fight. When you go overseas and you fight, you have to turn it up a few notches, you know, you have to be a little more aggressive, you have to relentless. You have to be a little more active. You know, you just got to do more because they're going to try to cheat you regardless. There's always, me and my wife always said, with all our many trips to Europe, we always say there's a judge in the pocket, always, sometimes two. But so you have to train accordingly and fight accordingly. So in that fight, I was still angry because, number one, they basically robbed me of my undefeated record. And, you know, they took that from me, you know, and so I just, man, I went ham on that guy. The first 6 rounds, I didn't care if he hit me. I was going to hit him 4 more times. If he hit me twice, I was going to hit him 8 times. You know, that's just the way I felt. And it was just a funny thing. The ring was a funny material. It got real slippery after the 7th round, and yeah, it was just crazy, man. It was crazy. But you know what? We still got the victory, and that belt was draped around my waist after that fight.
What led you to move up from cruiserweight to the heavyweight division?
Oh man, that right there is a little funny story. I mean, because here it is, I lost Fort Troy Ross, got it back, 2-time world champion. I signed with the Germans in order to solidify a lucrative rematch with Marco Huck, who I stopped in the 12th round. But Marco Huck now has been, you know, he defended the WBO title probably like 6 times, and he was making a lot of money. So we figure we go over there and make some money because the cruiserweight made no money in America. And at that time, I had already beaten Darchik, who was now WBC cruiserweight champion. I had already beaten Marco Huck, WBO champion, and Guillermo Jones, who was WBA champion. So I beat all the title holders already. None of them wanted to unify, you know. So wow. I was stuck as a cruiserweight fighting my mandatory. Then I got the fight with Hernandez and the portal robbery, and I rematched him, and I lost the rematch. And I was like, wow, I can't stay cruiserweight because those guys didn't want to fight me with a belt. So I could only imagine trying to get a fight without a belt where guys didn't even have to fight me. And there was nothing, you know, there wasn't even an incentive at the end of the line for him. So I felt I kind of got elbowed out of the cruiserweight division because nobody really wanted to fight me. I mean, we tried everybody. We tried Danny Green. We tried Tarver. We tried, because, you know, after Tarver beat Green, you know, because he was IBO champ, we tried Huck. We found out that they didn't want me to fight Huck again because they knew I would beat him, and Huck was the money for the company at the time. Guillermo Jones, I wouldn't fight Guillermo Jones again because he was with Don King, and I just didn't want to deal with him. And I knew that was going to be a shady deal anyway, so that just wasn't an option. But and Krzysztof Łodarczyk, no one was really here it is, I'm fighting these guys, and Krzysztof is at my fight, cheering me on, you know, in Germany. So I just couldn't get any fights. So heavyweight, I mean, really, after the fight with Hernandez, if everything would have went according to plan and the Hernandez fight, the first fight, wasn't such a blatant robbery, we were going to vacate the IBF title and move up to heavyweight anyway. But with that went down the way it did, I decided to rematch him, and we didn't win that, and I just was like, you know what, I'm going to just go ahead and go to heavyweight, and that, you know, because it was the next best thing. I couldn't go light heavyweight.
Yeah. Well, you lost two close fights to Thomas Adamek, which, well, we know how that goes in your career where, I mean, you lose fights that you don't really lose. Do fights like those that were obviously stolen from you ever make you wonder if all this is even worth it?
You know what? They do. I'm not gonna say they don't. They totally do. I mean, when you go to training camp and you put you just sacrifice family time. You sacrifice, you know, stuff that you want to do, and you you just work in order to attain this goal. You figure if I go beat this guy, I'm gonna be rewarded for beating him, but when you fight and then it doesn't happen like that, when you do beat the guy and you don't get rewarded for it, you darn right you say, man, why am I doing this? You know, like, why? But that faith that's within me, dwell on that long, you know, it just won't. I mean, and here's the thing, those fights that they say I lost, I did damn great in. You know, I beat Tomas Adamek the second fight. Even the Tyson Fury fight, that Fury should have been disqualified, but in the Glasgow fight, you know, I freaking spanked Glasgow. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, those things that happen, they don't. The faith that's in me makes that it turns that anger, and it turns that, oh man, why am I doing this? It turns that into, I'm going to work harder. I'm going to work harder to where they can't do this to me anymore. You know, that's my goal. You know what I'm saying? Now that's my goal. I'm going to work so hard and beat this dude's butt so bad to where I dare you to rob me. You know, because with the second Adamek fight, I mean, that was I'm a crucial critic of myself. I give myself an 8.5 boxing lesson on that fight. I mean, I made Adamek look like an amateur in there, you know, and that was a no-brainer. Steve Cunningham wins. But then there's a draw, and, oh, hold up, it's a split decision. Well, you know, it's just shadiness. It's just ridiculous. So that drove me back to the drawing board. Not even back to the drawing board. That just took me back to the gym, back to camp with an even much more meaningful drive. Same thing with the Fury fight. Same thing with this glass. And then, like I said, the main major thing is, this is summing up right here. After the Glasgow fight, I mean, my team was mad. I mean, I saw Brother Nazim in a way I'd never seen him before. And we had to go check on him in his room because we're like, man, making sure he's all right, because he's just like, this stuff is not right. He's like, well, they just keep doing this to you. And I said, well, listen, I said, it could have been worse. And everybody looked at me like, what? I said, he could have beat me up. He could have really beat me. You know? But I'm like, the fact is, I kicked his butt. The world saw it on HBO. They saw me having his guy spit his mouthpiece out. You know, they saw me fight in my, fourth undefeated heavyweight in a row. You know, they saw Steve Cunningham, the small heavyweight that everybody writes off. They saw me do my thing again, but yet they saw me get cheated again. So it just gives me drive, man. It gives me drive, and I'm more determined than ever to go out here and show and prove.
You know, unfortunately, with you being on the receiving end of all these bad decisions, you're very qualified to answer this next question. So because of your experience, what do you think can be done or should be done to clean up the scoring of boxing matches?
I'm going to tell you, there's a few things that need to be done. The first major thing that I say needs to be done is the fans need to really step up and speak up right along with the fighter. The real hardcore fans. I know we have those fans that just, you know, oh, hey, somebody's fighting. It's going to be a fight this week in town. Let's go. They get drunk and they have friends. That's cool. And I love those fans too. But we've got those hardcore fans that follow fighters, that know boxing, that can tell you a guy's stats. You know, those fans are in huge numbers. And they're the ones who really pay these pay-per-views. The fans are the ones who pay the money to see these fights, you know, who pay the tickets, who fill the seats. They have the say. So if the fans step up with the fighter and fans, if we ever had a fighter and fan committee that addresses judging, that addresses certain corruptions in boxing, I think we could make a difference. I mean, that will help because, I mean, fans could say, listen, we're going to boycott such and such fight that who judged Steve Cunningham versus Adamick, a win for Adamick. We're going to boycott that fight. We're going to not go to that fight. You know what I mean? It takes people to get together to really do something about it. I mean, this is a sport that people love. I mean, I love it. That's why I haven't left it. I love it. I love being in shape. I love performing. The fans, they love to come. They love to root for a guy. Some of these fans used to box themselves, and they understand this. Something like that needs to happen. Or, I mean, then you have to check. We have these judges that, we have to see what kind of standards that these judges are being held to in order to judge fights. You know, it's like, what are you looking for? You know, I thought it was ring generalship, you know, punches landed, you know, power punches and defense, you know, but it seems it's just these judges just want guys to just stand in front of each other and just knock each other's heads off. And that's not boxing, you know. It's not boxing.
All right, real quick, we got about 3 minutes left on a live portion of the show, so we will have another 15 minutes of archive time, as always, as everybody that listens to this every week knows. So we'll cut off at 11:30, but you can go to our Facebook page, you go to Blog Talk Radio, you can go to Spreaker, many avenues to follow the grueling truth, and you can hear the rest of it. This last 15 minutes we're about to do with Steve Cunningham, former Cruiserweight Champion of the World. At the top of the hour, midnight, the entire interview will be up. So let's get to, I mean, I remember seeing, the fight I remember most about you was your fight against Amir Mansour, which was an epic fight. And that's the first time I heard about your daughter, Kennedy, who was born with a heart defect, which worsened around the age of 9, about the time you fought him. Now, the thing that I remember about it, even though it was a great fight, but not the fact that it was a great fight. It was after you beat Mansour, which I thought for sure they'd steal that decision for you because it was a pretty close fight. But the thing I remember most about it was him at the end of the fight taking the microphone and talking to the crowd and telling them what your situation was. And I know I read in a boxing magazine like a month later how when you got up the next morning, you get on Facebook and you got all kind of people that want to help. Just explain to us what it felt to have another fighter that you just beat go out of his way to do that, and then just tell us a little bit about your daughter.
Well, first, you know, me and Mansour were pretty, I ain't going to say pretty, I mean, we knew each other, we were acquaintances, we were friends, you know. He helped me get ready for Troy Ross to get my title back the second time, you know. He got out of jail and he came straight to the gym and we were working. I would see him around Philly. We talked, and then we got the car. So fighting him was pretty rough. You know, I didn't want to do it, but, you know, sometimes you got to fight your friends in this business. And after the fight, with me getting the victory and him taking that microphone and saying what he said, and I didn't hear this until after a day after the fight. You know, it was on Facebook. Somebody posted it on my wall, and I was like, wow. I mean, that just goes to show you that you know, us fighters, we're not animals. We're not, you know, foaming at the mouth to kill somebody. You know, we're humans. We're fathers. We're brothers. You know, we're family men, and we're friends. You know, and in actuality, that speech he gave started the fund for my daughter. We needed a fund. We started a fund because we needed to get to Pittsburgh in such a fast time in order for her to get the transplant, because we were too far away and we needed to basically be living there. So after he said give to the fund, we didn't have one. And I was like, well, let's start one and see what happens. And, man, about 2 months later, $30,000, man. I mean, the boxing world really showed love for us, man. So I'm infinitely indebted to the boxing world and to the community who really show love for us, and Mansoor, no doubt.
Yeah. All right, so just tell us. I know that, I believe, last year, at the end of last year, like November or December, she actually had a heart transplant. How is she doing today?
December 5th was the heart transplant date, and it was one of the most joyous days of my life. You know, I've seen all three of my kids come into this world. You know, I was there. I was right there when they came out, and that's the number one joyous days of my life. But this right here is like another birth. You know, she got another chance at life, and she's doing awesome, man. I mean, they let her. She was doing so great that they allowed her to come home for Christmas for the day. You know, 20 days after the transplant, she was allowed to come home for 24 hours, and then a couple weeks after that, she was able to come home permanently. And she's just been, man, she's just been knocking these stats out the window, man. I mean, out the roof. You know, we're just so, we're a blessing. Blessing doesn't even fit what we went through with this transplant. I mean, there's no words to express. I'm just praising God, man, straight up.
That's great.
Well, coming up in August, you have your meeting with Antonio Tarver. And usually, you know, we were brought up to respect our elders, but I would imagine that night you're not going to have much respect for him. What are your thoughts on the Tarver fight?
I'm not going to show him any respect at all. I mean, you know, I'm just going to do him just like every other fighter. But he is a legend. He's a legend killer. You know, he beat Roy. He's the one who set Roy on a down spiral to an extent. And, you know, you have to respect that. I don't care how old he is. You know, he's 46 or whatever. But he's still that guy. You know, I just got to get in there and show him he's not. You understand? We're training for that Tarver that beat Roy. You know, so much respect to his skill level, what he's done. He did some great things as an amateur. Shoot, I remember when I was an amateur training at the Navy gym. This is crazy. At the Navy gym, there was a picture of the 1996 Olympic team, and Tarver was on that team. And I just kept looking at him because I'm like, he's a light heavyweight. I'm a light heavyweight. Like, wow, I wonder how I would fare against him. Of course, he would have killed me back then. But, you know, I just all constantly looked at that picture, man. And it's funny, I get to fight this man. So, I'm going to come correct, no doubt, man, no doubt.
Yeah, you fought Tyson Fury. I mean, people say it was controversial. I don't.
Yep.
I mean, he cheated. He illegally, the forearm shiver, whatever it was, and then the knockout.
Yeah.
He's getting ready to fight Vladimir Klitschko. What are your thoughts on Fury, and do you think he has a chance against Klitschko?
A guy 6'9", and I've been to camp with Fury since our fight. You know, I went to camp with him for 4 weeks. Him and his team work out, and his uncle Peter doesn't play around. You know, Tyson has an engine, and you know Tyson can go. He's in shape. He just talks so much, you just don't care for the guy. You know, but he's in shape and he's willing to learn, and he's 6'9". You know, so you can't count a guy out like that. You know, and he's hungry. I know for a fact. You know, I've talked with him numerous times before. I mean, after and during the camp. And he's hungry, you know. He wants to gain respect, and he knows beating Vladimir will get him that, or he feels that. But you have Vladimir Klitschko, you know, a decorated amateur, a doggone heavyweight that's going to go down in history with his brother, you know, dominant heavyweight. it's going to be a good fight. I can't call fights, man. I try not to call fights because, you know, you got a hungry guy and you got a veteran. It's going to be a good fight. I'm going to be sitting in the edge of my seat for this fight. But one thing I will say about Vladimir is Vladimir does tend to do very well against taller guys. You know, he destroyed Watch. I think he fought another tall guy, taller than him, a few times. And he does pretty darn good with taller guys. So we'll see, man. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay, Joe.
You know, you're 36, and usually fighters are either retired or on their way out of 36. But you look like a youthful 36. How much longer do you want to fight?
I'll be 39 next week, man.
39. Wow. So you still look very youthful. So my question is even more relevant. So how much longer?
I mean, you know, there was time after that second Adamic fight, after that robbery, I told my wife and my trainer, I said, you know what? If I would have made the money that a two-time champion that people thought I had made, millions or whatever, and of course we're smart with our money, we would have invested it and then had it working for us. I was like, I probably would have left boxing then. You know, I was that disappointed with boxing at the time, with the business of boxing. But I'm like, I can't leave because, one, I still feel there's more for me to do. I still feel there's more for me to get, and there's money to be made. You know, I want to show the world that I can be world champion at heavyweight also. So I live boxing, you know. Even when I don't have a fight, I'm in the gym. I'm working. I'm living right. I don't party. I mean, you know, me and my wife will go out here and there, but I'm not a party guy. You know, I'm not a drinker, like, per se. A can of beer would do Steve Cunningham in. So if you want to see me on the floor, give me a glass of beer.
It will Joe Rodriguez, too.
Yeah, I'm done.
Right.
You know, so that's how much of a lightweight I am when it comes to alcohol. So, I mean, I just don't get down like that. You know, I live for the family, you know, and my son boxes. I train my son. I train my nephew. I train my cousin. My little boy, Cruz, my four-year-old, he just did his first sparring today. Got that on Facebook and Instagram. I'm all family, you know. So we live box. We are boxing. You know, we're a boxing family. So I live it, and I think that's part of the reason why I'm so youthful and I feel good. I mean, and I'm still learning. So my body feels great. You have your little aches and pains here and there, but, you know, this 38, 39, I feel stronger than I did when I was 25. I mean, to tell you the truth. So, but in actuality, I don't want to be fighting in my 40, 45, and, you know, but if I'm able to generate money, you know, and still protect myself and put on a good show for the fans, yeah, I mean, why not? But ideally, I don't want to be boxing after, like, 43. You know, I just really don't want it.
All right, we got about 5 minutes left. I was going to ask you, I mean, I think you're working with Al Haymon now, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what's your opinion of Al Haymon? What's he like to work for? I know a lot of people trash him, but they're usually promoters that can't keep up with him. But what's your take on it?
Listen, I'm going to keep it frank and blunt. My take on Al Haymon is, this is the way boxing should have been done from the beginning. That's my take. These other guys, they're mad. I believe they're angry because they see what he's doing. Number one, he's giving boxing back to the fans. I mean, not just a C level. He's giving boxing back on an A-plus level back to the fans on network television. It's unbelievable. So, but when you had those other guys who were basically hoarding it, and don't even get me, this is a whole nother show on how the fighter got treated, you know, the money that fighters made, you know, it's ridiculous. Al Haymon is doing it the way it should be done. He's setting a precedent, and these guys, those other guys who were doing it the old way, are angry. The way they were doing it benefited them way more than it benefited the fighter. Al Haymon, it benefits the fighter way more than it benefits anything else, which is the way it should be. Without the fighter, there is no boxing, period. There's no promoter to promote a fighter without a fighter. There's no manager. There's no show. Nobody makes money if the fighter says, I'm not fighting today. So treat it like, treat him like that. You know, and he's getting treated like that right now. I'm 100% behind Al Heyman. I was even behind Al Heyman before I was with him. Me and my wife, because and if you look at the history, I was fighting on NBC, and Al basically took NBC from Main Event. But me and my wife went. We weren't that mad because we're like, wow, Camp. You know, I love what he's doing. That's awesome, actually. You know, but then it was wow. Wish I was on board. But we are now, you know, so what he's doing is awesome. That's the way boxing should be done, you know. The fighter should not be making peanuts. I mean, don't get me started on the amount of money that I made for me and Mansoor made. That was ridiculously low. I mean, disgracefully low. But and we put on an awesome fight. But
well, I would imagine the only time you made any money was when you were a cruiserweight fighting in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. That's when I made my most money. I made a pretty good, significant, good purse fight in Adamic the first time. The second time, it was a pale in comparison to it at heavyweight. And people say, oh, you go to heavyweight to make money. Well, shoot. I haven't seen that type of money. But, you know, now that we've moved to Heyman, you know, things are looking different. And there's just a more of a care for the fighter. Per se, not as much as the business. You know what I mean? And me and my wife, when we talked with Al, we were in shock with the things that he was saying that was going on. And we're like, this can't be real. You know, because we were so used to getting screwed, you know, and getting done the dirty way. It's just like, wow. It's like you take an abused woman, you take a battered woman, and she got a good man now. You know, it's like, hold up. This exists? You know, this they're really out here. You know what I'm saying? That's how we feel.
Well, we're almost out of time. It was an honor having you on. I mean, the story, I knew a little bit about it from watching the Mansoor fight, but then when I started doing a little research today, actually, and started reading everything, I mean, your journey's been amazing. And the one thing that really stands out to me is the fact that today, most people don't learn from their mistakes. You know, and it's not the mistakes you make that make you a man. It's your ability to overcome those mistakes and right them. And, I mean, after you whoop Antonio Tarver's butt, we would love to have you back on.
Oh, man, just let me know, man. I'll be there.
Joe,
well,
you got any final words?
Guys here rooting for, you have two guys here rooting for you to beat his butt. So definitely take care of business and get out in one piece and be safe. And I hope you make a huge payday down the road.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it, man. Much respect.
All right, man. Thanks for calling in, Steve.
All right, thanks for having me, guys. Anytime.
All right.
Thank you,
thanks
Steve. All the best.
All right, Joe. That was a pretty good interview, don't you think?
Yeah. Let me tell you, I'm surprised that he hasn't had more opportunities to be in front of the camera. He's a very articulate man. He knows the game, obviously.
Yeah. Very impressive,
actually.
I think he was just stuck where he was always put as the B-side fighter on somebody else's. It's like we talked earlier on the phone. It kind of reminded me of Glenn Johnson. You know, Glenn Johnson had 13, 14 losses in his career, but probably 10 of them weren't legitimate because he was stuck having to go overseas to fight somebody to make some money.
I wouldn't be surprised if Steve has a nice career after he's finished fighting with commentating, and I also wouldn't be surprised if he makes as much or more money commentating. So, you know, that
Yeah, very impressive, and I know I will definitely be watching that fight now, and I bet you do now, too.
Absolutely, now that he and I are close personal friends.
Yeah, plus the fact of this, Antonio Tarver beat Rocky Balboa, and I cannot cheer for anybody that ends Rocky Balboa's career, and we all know it was not a legit decision. It was a split decision. I think Balboa won every round from the fourth on. I don't know about you, but.
Oh, wow. Well, come back to reality.
So you think Tarver beat Balboa? All right. Plus, Tarver looks a little like a milk dud, but we'll let it go. But thanks for listening in tonight. We will be back next Tuesday night with a Grilling Truth Boxing show. We'll have a special guest then, hopefully, or me and Joe will just ramble on for 45 minutes. Thursday night, we got a special guest on the Grueling Truth football show with myself and my co-host, Matt Andrews Cabbage. We'll have former legendary Seattle Seahawks safety, Kenny Easley, on the show. And I bet Joe Rod might even call in that night.
I definitely will. He's an all-time great.
But all right, guys, thanks for listening in. Remember, you can catch us on Spreaker, the Grueling Truth Facebook